So usually when we talk about like a diagnostic tool, there is this fundamental expectation of precision.
Right, like you want a clear answer.
Exactly. Like you break your arm, the X-ray machine lights up that jagged white line against the dark background, and the doctor just taps the screen and it's like, there it is. The problem is visible, it's categorized, and it's contained.
Yeah, it provides a very comforting binary, you know? The bone is either fractured or it's intact. The human mind just craves that kind of visual confirmation because, well, it implies that a solution is just as straightforward.
Right. But the moment you take that exact same diagnostic lens and point it at modern societal structures like, our macroeconomy or our neighborhood dynamics or even the way we consume media, that machine completely shatters.
Oh, absolutely. It falls apart.
You are suddenly looking at a landscape of the human condition that is incredibly murky and built almost entirely on illusions. So today, we're exploring a source text that acts as a totally different kind of X-ray machine. We are taking a deep dive into a surreal, multi-layered, and just deeply deadpan comic strip centered around a protagonist named Marcus.
And we really need to establish right away that this is not some lightweight Sunday morning syndicated gag strip.
No, not at all.
We are looking at structural satire operating at the absolute highest level here.
Yeah, and to give you the perfect framing for what we are exploring today, I want to filter this through the exact lens the creator intended. See, but that is why I love Marcus, because in my mind, I want to say it's like, I imagine it like if American Dad, Family Guy, and the Boondocks had a baby.
Oh, wow. Yeah. That's quite a mix.
Right. And the life story of that baby was written by the writers of South Park, with the creator of the Boondocks as the showrunner. You feel me? That is kind of how I imagine it.
Yeah.
But in reality, like, Marcus is a surrogate for the creator,
Right,
right?
exactly a
So, but
vehicle.
yeah, and I love how it just lets the creator get their ideas off their chest. Like, it's written by somebody who is highly intellectual, has a clear understanding of life and the worldview, and is just putting a character and a group of characters through these things, right? It's really these real intellectual theses broken down into, comic strips that has that peak era, The Simpsons unblinking structural genius, but with a much sharper edge.
That framing is crucial, honestly, because it explains the mechanics of the strip. The creator is taking this grounded, highly observant character and just like feeding him along with his entire family into the meat grinder of modern existence simply to prove a point.
Yeah, to show how ridiculous it all is.
Right. Marcus is an intellectual vehicle. He doesn't just react to wacky sitcom situations. He is literally a walking diagnostic tool for late-stage capitalism and social performativity.
And we're going to walk right alongside him on this deep dive. We're going to track his navigation through the math of inflation, the absolute exhaustion of hustle culture, the weird performative theater of the modern internet, and, well, eventually a town that elects a literal Labrador retriever as its mayor.
Which is an incredible arc, by the way.
Oh, it's amazing. But to understand any of that, we have to start with Marcus himself. We have to look at his baseline philosophy, which is essentially weaponized literalism.
Weaponized literalism. I love that term for him.
Right. His defining trait across all these scripts is a complete refusal to get mad. He doesn't go on these long, self-righteous, like Aaron Sorkin-style monologues. He simply strips away the marketing of a situation and stares directly at the math.
Which is exactly why he is so disruptive to everyone around him. Marcus's superpower is his refusal to participate in the emotional theater that society demands.
Right.
Because when you refuse to validate a broken system's premise, you instantly expose how fragile that system actually is.
Totally. And there is a brilliant sequence right at the beginning of the run that perfectly illustrates this. So Marcus is standing with a friend who is scrolling on a phone. The friend announces, completely sincerely, they say inflation is stabilizing.
Just reading the headline.
Exactly. And the very next panel cuts to Marcus standing at a grocery store checkout lane. He has exactly two items on the belt. The total on the digital register reads
That's
$147.32.
two items.
Right. And in the final panel, Marcus just turns, looks directly at the reader with this signature, exhausted half smirk, and asks, stabilizing for who?
The efficiency of that storytelling is just remarkable. I mean, in three panels, the text completely dismantles the disconnect between macroeconomic narrative and microeconomic
Yeah,
reality.
it really does.
Because when a financial news network reports that inflation is stabilizing, they are using a highly specific corporate metric. They just mean the rate of acceleration has slowed down, which is, you know, great news for bond yields and corporate forecasting.
Sir, for the guys in suits.
Right. But for the individual standing in the grocery store, that macro stability is entirely irrelevant.
Because the damage is already baked into the cake. The new floor for basic survival is exorbitant.
Precisely. Marcus's deadpan reaction highlights the fact that stability is a luxury metric. Like, if the price of bread jumped 300% last year and only jumps 1% this year, the system calls that stability.
But the consumer is still trapped at the top of that 300% spike.
Exactly. Marcus refuses to let the linguistic trick of the word stabilizing distract him from the $147 reality sitting right there on the register.
And he applies that exact same unblinking logic to the media ecosystem, too. There was this one strip dissecting how local news covers crime. You have a television anchor shouting dramatically about crime spiraling out of control in the city.
Classic local news fear-mongering.
Right. But the creator uses a split-screen technique. Behind the panicked anchor, there is footage of a politician in a tailored suit smiling and shaking hands with a real estate developer at a ribbon-cutting ceremony for a massive new luxury condos project.
Oh, I remember this one.
Yeah, and Marcus is just sitting on his couch watching this broadcast, and he observes, they always show you the broken window, never the hands holding the rock.
Which is just a profound critique of how media and capital operate in a symbiotic loop. The broken window represents the street-level crime, right?
Right, the stuff that looks scary on TV.
Exactly. That is the visceral, scary footage the news station uses to keep viewership high and maintain a baseline level of public anxiety.
Gotta get those ratings.
Right, but the hands holding the rock are the invisible systemic forces. The aggressive gentrification, the corporate lobbying, the displacement of working-class families, those are the forces that actively create the desperate conditions where street-level crime flourishes.
The local news is literally pointing the camera at the symptom while actively shaking hands with the disease.
And Marcus sees the entire frame. He refuses to be distracted by the shattered glass because he is entirely focused on the trajectory of the stone.
Man, that is so good. And this literalism doesn't just apply to giant concepts like macroeconomics or media theory. He brings it right down to the neighborhood level. The Homeowners Association storyline is where this really crystallizes for me.
Oh, the HOA arc is a masterpiece of suburban dread.
It really is.
Yeah.
So Marcus, who is just a renter, somehow accidentally gets elected to the HOA board. The community decides they want fresh voices, and they think Marcus seems reasonable. And Marcus immediately notes that putting a reasonable person on an HOA board is usually a mistake.
Because institutions have a very skewed definition of the word reasonable.
Right. What do they actually mean?
Well, to a bureaucratic system, a reasonable person is simply a compliant person. It's someone who will enforce the rules without questioning their origin. They fail to understand that a genuinely reasonable human being will immediately recognize that bureaucratic rules are inherently irrational.
So he gets on the board, and the absurdity starts immediately. The HOA president sends out an urgent red flag email about a severe trash can violation. The attached photographic evidence shows a plastic trash can with the lid propped open maybe an inch.
A federal emergency, obviously.
Obviously. And Marcus just replies to the thread with one word, revolutionary.
I love that.
So the president gets super defensive and argues that they have to enforce strict fines because, quote, it's about standards. And Marcus just looks at him and asks, whose?
That single word, whose, strikes at the very foundation of localized power. The HOA presents its bylaws as objective, almost divine laws of neighborhood physics, you know?
Yeah, like it's a law of nature that your grass has to be exactly 2 inches tall.
Exactly. But Marcus exposes that these standards are entirely subjective, and they are usually designed to criminalize the realities of simply living.
And the hypocrisy becomes undeniable when the board receives a noise complaint. So a resident is throwing massive, loud parties every single weekend, disrupting the whole street. The HOA president immediately moves to table the complaint and ignore it because the guy throwing the parties is named Steve.
Good old Steve.
Right. And when Marcus asks why the lid of a trash can is a 5-alarm fire, but Steve gets to run a nightclub out of his garage, the president simply replies, Steve owns.
And there we have the mask slipping entirely. The illusion of objective rules is completely shattered.
Right.
Because the rules of the HOA aren't actually about maintaining order or preserving aesthetic beauty. They are selectively applied based entirely on who holds capital.
Yeah. As Marcus summarizes it later, it's not about order. It's about comfort.
The comfort of the property owning class at the expense of the renters. And Marcus just sits in the room and observes this dynamic out loud.
But consider the mechanics of that for a second. I look at Marcus in these situations and I think of, like, a mirror in a funhouse.
Okay, a funhouse mirror.
Yeah, like he is the only perfectly flat, unwarped surface in the entire room. And because he is flat, he makes all the distorted, curving mirrors around him look completely insane. But I keep coming back to this question. Is just being a flat mirror actually enough to change the room?
That's a great question.
Because he doesn't start a tenant union. You know, he doesn't scream at the HOA president. He doesn't flip the conference table. He just sits there in his chair being right. Is that a flaw in his philosophy?
Well, if that question really gets to the tragedy of his character design, you are asking what happens when a person simply refuses to validate the rules of a delusional system.
Yeah. Does the system wake up?
No. The historical answer is that the system doesn't suddenly realize its flaws and correct itself. The system violently expels the person pointing out the flaws. And that is exactly what the comic illustrates.
They literally call an emergency session to get rid of him.
Yes. The HOA president tells Marcus he isn't aligned. When Marcus points out the sheer absurdity of taking the position of a plastic trash can lid personally, they hold a snap vote and remove him from the board. Right.
And as he is walking away from the public comment microphone, his final parting shot is just devastatingly simple. He looks at the board and says, "Y'all bought houses next to humans."
Which is the ultimate crime in a suburb, acting like a human.
Exactly. Because just existing as a flat mirror is intolerable to an environment built entirely on illusions. They have to shatter the mirror to keep the funhouse operating.
Wow.
And the creator is making a very subtle argument here. If Marcus had participated in the outrage, if he had screamed and yelled and debated the HOA president, he would have actually been validating their authority.
Oh, because he'd be taking them seriously.
Right. He would be signaling that the game they're playing is real and worth getting upset over. By remaining completely passive and literal, he denies them the one thing they crave most, his belief in their power. He strips them of their authority by refusing to pretend they have any. That's deep. Now, if Marcus is the flat mirror, calmly reflecting reality, his uncle Reggie is a guy who has strapped a rocket to his back and is sprinting full speed into a painted tunnel on a brick wall, fully believing it's a real tunnel.
That is the perfect description of Uncle Reggie.
Reggie brings us into the absolute chaotic, hyper-capitalist delusion of hustle culture.
Reggie is the essential foil to Marcus. If Marcus is structural realism, Reggie is the relentless, exhausting pursuit of late-stage capitalism. Reggie has swallowed every single piece of propaganda the system has ever produced about upward mobility, and, well, it is slowly destroying him.
Yeah, Reggie's the guy who watches finance TikToks at 3 a.m. and thinks he's one mindset shift away from being a billionaire.
Oh, we all know a Reggie.
The script gives us this incredible sequence called the pre-liquid arc. So we open on Reggie sitting at the kitchen table. The table is entirely covered in frantic hand-drawn charts. He's got motivational YouTube videos, paws on a laptop.
Setting the scene of a true visionary.
Exactly. And he looks up at Marcus, who is just trying to pour a bowl of cereal, and declares that they are not broke. They are, quote, pre-liquid.
Pre-liquid.
And Marcus doesn't even pause pouring the milk. He just says, "That's just broke with confidence."
Pre-liquid is such a hauntingly brilliant phrase. It perfectly captures the linguistic hijacking that happens in hustle culture. I mean, Reggie is taking the highly specialized vocabulary of venture capital and high finance, and he is trying to forcefully apply it to neighborhood grifts and multi-level marketing schemes.
He's trying to sound like a CEO.
Right. He understands the cadence of wealth. He drops words like synergy, residuals, overhead, compounding.
But he has zero capital to back any of those words up. Like, Reggie dramatically opens a cardboard box on the table to reveal his master plan for generational wealth. And what's inside? It is a chaotic mix of Mary Kay makeup samples, off-brand energy drinks, motivational DVDs, essential oils, and a crumpled pamphlet about cryptocurrency.
An incredibly diversified portfolio.
Marcus looks into the box and notes that Reggie is selling everything but groceries.
When you look closely at that box, Reggie isn't actually building a business. He is desperately trying to assemble the aesthetic of an entrepreneur. He thinks that if he mimics the chaotic diversification of a massive conglomerate, the wealth will just magically manifest.
But it gets so bleak when he tallies up his sales for the week. He writes down the number $17. And he proudly taps the paper and calls it compounding. Marcus just stares at the paper and replies, "Compounded disappointment."
Which is just brutal.
But here is the cruelest part of the satire. The comic actually lets Reggie win for a split second. We get the crypto spike.
And the momentary illusion of victory is the worst thing that can happen to a gambler.
So true. Reggie pivots entirely to crypto because some teenager on the internet told him a specific coin was about to do a 100x return. So for a week, he is glued to his phone. And then one morning, he is just staring at the screen, physically sweating. The screen is glowing green.
The dream realized.
Right. He slowly turns the phone around to show Marcus. The portfolio balance reads plus $42,000. And for the very first time in the entire series, Marcus is genuinely stunned. He looks at the screen and whispers, "Liquid."
And we have to pay really close attention to how Reggie reacts to that moment. Does he secure the funds? Does he pay off debt?
Absolutely not. Within an hour, Reggie is wearing dark sunglasses inside the house.
Of course he is.
He starts using words like leverage and patience. He goes out and rents a Lamborghini just for the afternoon so he can take photos for his Instagram grid. He transforms the living room into a seminar space and starts inviting other struggling people from the neighborhood over, standing at a whiteboard, telling them they need to see beyond broke.
He instantly transforms into a prophet of wealth.
Instantly.
Which perfectly illustrates the sociological trap of sudden capital. Success, even the temporary unrealized illusion of success on a screen, instantly obliterates humility.
It's like a switch flipped.
Right, because the system doesn't just want you to make money. It forces you to perform your success until you become a mirror image of the very monsters that originally oppressed you. Reggie doesn't have any desire to dismantle the oppressive financial hierarchy. His only goal is to finally be the one sitting at the top of it.
But we are living in Marcus's universe, which means gravity always wins. The market dips, the chart goes into freefall. The next morning, Reggie is sitting in the exact same chair, staring blankly at a screen that is violently red.
Easy come, easy go.
Marcus is back to eating his cereal. He looks over at Reggie and just says, "Back to potential." And when Reggie, still high on the delusion, quietly says that the next coin is going to hit because they have the right mindset, Marcus delivers the absolute killing blow of the arc. He says, "We cyclical."
We cyclical. It is a devastating summary of poverty under modern capitalism. What the creator is dissecting here is the absolute commodification of hope. Reggie is never actually selling energy drinks or crypto tokens. He is selling himself the feeling of escaping his current reality. And the comic draws a brilliant direct parallel between Reggie's street-level delusion and the absolute highest levels of global power.
Oh, you are talking about the prisoner's pen analogy. This is arguably the sharpest piece of writing in the entire source text. We have to walk through the mechanics of this scene.
Let's do it.
So Marcus is sitting on the couch with his young nephew, Malik. They are watching a televised presidential address. The president is sitting in the Oval Office talking about global stability. On a split screen, the news is showing military missiles being loaded onto aircraft.
By state.
Right. And the president holds up a very sleek, expensive-looking pen. He looks into the camera and tells the nation, "This pen represents strength, consistency, precision, and the ability to act when it matters most."
A classic political prop.
The news chyrons immediately start praising his resolute leadership. And Marcus turns to little Malik and says, "He sold a pen. War isn't announced. It's marketed."
It's a masterful piece of political deconstruction right there. The president is using a prop to launder an act of incredible violence into a narrative of steady reliability.
Right. But then, the very next morning, Uncle Reggie comes striding into the kitchen. He is holding a sleek silver pen. He walks up to Marcus and delivers the exact same pitch.
Word for word.
He says, "You ever needed to sign something important and the pen just didn't work? This ain't just a pen. This is reliability, consistency, precision."
And Malik recognizes it.
Malik, who is sitting at the table, realizes that Reggie is doing a word-for-word cover of the president's speech. So Marcus looks at Reggie and asks how much the pen costs. Reggie said $40. Marcus looks at it and asks, "What does it actually do?"
A very Marcus question.
Reggie hesitates, looks at the pen, and says, "It writes well." Marcus leans back, shakes his head, and says, "You selling the feeling again."
Wow. That interaction synthesizes the core trick of modern marketing, political campaigning, and hustle culture into one seamless moment.
It's all the same trick.
It really is. The comic is arguing that the President of the United States and Uncle Reggie are operating in the exact same industry. The only variable is the scale of the grift.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
They are both selling an emotional, abstract narrative to mask a purely transactional, often destructive reality. Whether the product is a $40 piece of metal or a multi-billion dollar military escalation, the consumer is just paying for the illusion of control.
But I look at Reggie and I can't help but feel a deep sense of pity for the guy. It's like watching someone play a game of Monopoly where they land on Baltic Avenue on the first turn, mortgage every single piece of property they own, and take out massive loans just to put a single hotel on the cheapest square on the board.
Right, a terrible financial move.
It is a completely doomed, mathematically terrible strategy.
Mm.
But what else is he supposed to do? It is literally the only square he can afford to land on. He has to sell the feeling of the $40 pen because he doesn't own the factory that makes the ink. He is playing the only hand he was dealt.
And the source material absolutely recognizes that tragedy. It doesn't hate Reggie. It mourns him. And that mourning reaches its darkest, most uncomfortable peak in the Healing Capital arc. This is where the satire pushes past mere economics and enters the monetization of the human soul.
Or the all-of-me grief hustle. This part of the script is hard to even read.
It's very bleak.
So we see Reggie standing alone in a cemetery. He is standing over a grave, and he has a massive boombox on his shoulder, blasting John Legend's All of Me at maximum volume. At first, Marcus is watching from a distance, and he assumes Reggie is just processing his grief in a very loud, performative, unique way.
A moment of genuine, albeit eccentric, human vulnerability.
Exactly.
Hmm.
But then Reggie goes home. He opens his laptop and starts frantically researching search terms like grief funnels and trauma-based branding.
Oh.
Yes. He actually tries to franchise the emotional release he felt at the cemetery. He books a room at a local community center and hosts a group healing session. He charges an entry fee, and then he upsells the attendees. He tells them it's an extra $20 if they want to dedicate the John Legend song to a specific relative.
He creates a microtransaction out of mourning. It's unbelievable.
Marcus is standing in the doorway of the community center, just watching this unfold, thinking, this man is selling sadness wholesale.
Mm-hmm.
When Marcus confronts him, Reggie defends the business model by saying, pain got recurring revenue.
Pain got recurring revenue. That line is the thesis of the entire modern wellness and therapy industry, condensed into five words.
It really is.
Under the crushing weight of late-stage capitalism, Reggie has internalized the idea that if an emotion is not actively generating revenue, it is a waste of personal resources.
If it's not making money, it's not worth feeling.
Exactly. He takes his own broken heart and tries to file it as a Delaware LLC. But we have to look at why the business ultimately fails.
Because it fails quickly. The people leave the community center because listening to a boombox doesn't actually resolve their complex grief. Reggie is left standing in an empty room, and he realizes a brutal truth about the market he is trying to tap into. He says people don't want to heal together. They want to be seen healing.
A very modern phenomenon.
Right. But then the satire drops away for a second. The room is totally empty. Reggie looks down at the boombox, his shoulders slump, and he quietly admits that he just really misses the person who died.
Oh.
Yeah. The entire hustle, the tickets, the funnels, the branding, it was all just a desperate shield to keep him from having to sit quietly with his own pain.
It is a devastating bait and switch. The creator makes you laugh at the absurdity of a grief franchise and then punches you in the gut with the reality of why someone would build it.
Reggie is completely powerless.
He is, but what's fascinating structurally is how the comic contrasts Reggie's desperate, failed chase for power with Marcus's trajectory. Because while Reggie is bleeding himself dry trying to acquire a tiny fraction of authority, Marcus constantly, accidentally stumbles into massive systemic power.
Yes, this transitions us perfectly into the surrealism of accidental authority. The script takes this massive South Park-style escalation where the stakes get astronomically high, but it maintains that flat, deadpan tone.
It's so funny.
Marcus keeps getting thrust into these positions of immense leadership, and he is almost immediately fired every single time because he is too literal to play the game.
The recurring motif here is the tension between compliance and effectiveness. Bureaucratic systems demand compliance above all else. And Marcus, on a biological level, is utterly incapable of compliance.
Let's examine the executive casual storyline. So through a convoluted, unexplained international election error, Marcus accidentally becomes the interim president of a volatile foreign nation.
As one does.
Naturally. He is standing at a massive podium, wearing a presidential sash over a hoodie, looking out of a screaming, adoring crowd. He leans into the microphone and just says, I thought this was jury duty.
Oh, deadpan.
Fast forward to a tense hostage negotiation. His advisors tell him that global oil futures are stabilizing simply because he isn't panicking. In Washington, D.C., American officials are watching him on a satellite feed, and they are terrified. One general says he's not playing the game. He don't even look stressed. That's hostile.
Hostile palm. It is a brilliant observation of geopolitical theater. In the realm of international relations, every leader is expected to perform a specific type of anxiety.
Right. They have to look worried.
Yes. The performance of stress is what justifies the existence of the military-industrial complex. If a leader simply sits down, looks at the math, and refuses to panic, the entire industry of crisis management is suddenly out of a job. His calm is literally an economic threat.
So the CIA abducts him.
Of course they do.
They throw him in an interrogation room. An agent slams his hands on the table and screams, "Why are you trying to destabilize the region?" Marcus looks up and replies, "I asked for fair trade." The agent frantically writes down radical redistribution rhetoric.
They can't comprehend someone just asking for fairness.
Finally, the agent tries to domesticate him. He tosses Marcus a tailored suit and says, "Put this on, you'll pull better domestically." Marcus slowly unfolds his Nike Tech tracksuit, puts it on, and calmly states, "I ain't domestic."
It is the ultimate rejection of the costume of power. This theme of resisting alignment repeats constantly throughout the series.
It really does.
Whether Marcus is serving as an interim president or filling in as a corporate drone, the system's primary objective is to force him to align with its culture. Think back to the corporate office arc in the first issue. The HR representative sits him down and proudly explains that they are a mission-driven synergy collective operating within the Human Capital Optimization Division.
Just a word salad of corporate jargon.
Complete word salad. And Marcus listens to the buzzwords, blinks, and asks, "So, y'all sell humans?"
And they fire him by Friday.
Naturally.
The HR rep tells him he isn't aligned with company culture. And Marcus just smirks, grabs his box of desk supplies, and says, "I wasn't aligned with rent either. But here we are."
But we need to look closer at the mechanics of why he gets fired from these authoritative roles. Let's look at his stint as an interim principal at a failing public school.
Okay, this is where it gets really confusing for me, and I need you to explain the psychology here. Marcus takes over this struggling school. He calls an assembly. He doesn't give them a motivational speech. He tells the students flat out that institutions like control.
A very dangerous thing to say to children.
Right. He decides to teach them the concept of ownership instead of obedience. He instructs them to learn exactly when they need to ask for permission and when they should just act. And the results are undeniable. Test scores skyrocket. Student attendance is higher than it's been in a decade. Disciplinary referrals completely vanish back out.
He fixed the school.
He did. So what happens? The teachers are terrified. The school board holds an emergency hearing. They accuse him of radicalizing the youth because the kids are suddenly asking critical questions, and they fire him immediately. Why fire him if he fixed it?
Because you are assuming the goal of the school board is to educate children.
Well, isn't it?
No. The goal of the institution is to preserve the institution.
Wait, really?
Yes. Consider the analogy of a mechanic. Imagine you take your car to a dealership because it's running terribly. The service manager tells you that you need a new engine, premium gas, and a $5,000 overhaul. But a rogue mechanic walks out, looks at your car, and says, "You don't need any of that. You just left the parking brake on."
Right.
He disengages the brake, and the car runs perfectly. The dealership is going to fire that mechanic immediately.
Because they lose the $5,000.
Exactly. Not because he was wrong, but because he just cost them a massive repair job. By fixing the root problem, he eliminated the customer's dependency on the dealership.
Wow. If Marcus frees the student from needing the institution's permission to think, the institution loses its authority over the student.
Exactly. The same dynamic plays out when he accidentally becomes a provisional therapist. He sits down with a severely depressed client. Instead of endlessly validating the client's vague sense of malaise and booking them for 40 more sessions, Marcus looks at their chart.
And what does he see?
He points out that they work 60 hours a week for minimum wage with no health care. He tells them, "Your brain isn't broken, your job is."
And the client realizes it's the environment, not them.
Right. The client has a massive weeping breakthrough. They realize their misery is structural, not chemical. They are cured. And the clinic fires Marcus for crossing comfortable boundaries.
Because if you cure the patient, you lose the recurring revenue. It's Reggie's pain got recurring revenue, but on a corporate sanitized scale.
That's the exact parallel.
As Marcus tells his students when he's packing up his principal's desk into a cardboard box, they don't fire you for being wrong. They fire you for being early.
Systems do not exist to solve problems. They exist to manage problems indefinitely so that the administrators of the system remain employed.
Man, that is bleak. That corporate commodification of human beings, this desperate need for institutions to manage our behavior rather than actually liberate us, bleeds directly into how modern media and culture operate.
Oh, the media arcs are fantastic.
The creator takes Marcus on a press tour, pushing him into these hyper-modern media spaces. And it is hilarious because these platforms are designed to extract highly emotional content from their guests, and Marcus just hands them flat, unmarketable reality.
The modern media ecosystem is just another extraction industry. They don't mine for coal, they mine for engagement. And truth is notoriously bad for engagement.
Let's talk about his appearance on the podcast. He gets booked on one of those loud, aggressively lit, Joe Budden-style hip-hop podcasts. The room is full of guys screaming over each other, veins popping in their necks, desperately trying to drag Marcus into a debate about Drake versus Kendrick Lamar.
The ultimate internet debate.
Right. They are demanding to know who is superior, who is the better pen game, who is actually feeding the streets. And Marcus just sits quietly in his leather chair, letting them yell until the host literally forces a microphone into his face and demands an answer.
And Marcus just completely deflates the room.
He really does. Marcus sighs and points out the mechanical reality to the situation. He notes that the industry has positioned one artist as a consumer product and the other as a moral conscience, and then forces the fans to pick a side as if choosing a billionaire to defend is a personality trait.
He deconstructs the entire premise of the debate instead of participating in it.
He shuts the whole room down by stating, "Substance without consistency is just a lecture." And then he drops the absolute thesis of the episode. He says, "Beef sell, ownership don't trend. That's the real divide."
It is a surgical strike on how modern culture is consumed. The podcast hosts don't care about hip hop. They want a provocative 15-second soundbite about a rap beef to feed the YouTube algorithm.
Yeah, they just want the clip.
Exactly. But Marcus pulls the curtain back and points out that the beef itself is a corporate distraction. While the fans are fighting over lyrics, the executives who actually own the masters are quietly collecting the revenue from both artists.
He ruins their content by giving them context.
He ruins the vibe.
And he does the exact same thing on the modern dating shows. He goes on one of those pop the balloon shows that go viral on TikTok.
Oh, I've seen those.
Yeah. So a single man stands in front of a line of 20 women holding balloons. If the women aren't interested in what the man says, they pop their balloon with a needle. The host runs up to Marcus and asks, "What are you looking for in a woman?" Marcus just shrugs and says, "Peace."
The host doesn't know what to do with that.
The host laughs nervously and says, "No, bro. Like, physically. What are the dimensions?" Marcus looks confused and replies, "Ooh. I thought we was being honest."
He refuses to play the role of the shallow consumer.
And it gets better. The host starts interviewing the women. Several of them aggressively state that they are highly independent, they make their own money, and they absolutely do not need a man for anything. Marcus listens to this, leans into the microphone, and genuinely asks, "Then why we here?"
A perfectly logical question.
The women start popping their balloons in anger. Finally, before the segment can end, Marcus just walks down the line and pops all the remaining balloons himself. The host is completely stunned. Marcus hands him the needle and says, "I wasn't shopping. I was observing."
He treats modern dating content exactly for what it is. It's an audition for the algorithm, not a genuine search for human connection. He recognizes that everyone in that room is performing a highly stylized version of gender dynamics just to increase their follower count.
And this performative nature peaks at the feminist roundtable arc. Marcus is invited to sit on a Black Men's Healing roundtable. It is explicitly set up and marketed as a safe, vulnerable space for deep emotional work.
Very trendy right now.
Right. But the cameras start rolling, and within 3 minutes, it turns into an intellectual cage match. The men start aggressively arguing over the academic definitions of patriarchy. They are debating whether toxic masculinity is a biblical flaw or a byproduct of corporate structure. They're essentially competing to see who can appear the most perfectly healed.
Performing their healing for the camera.
Exactly. At one point, a famous actor delivers this incredibly polished, tearful monologue about the importance of listening.
It is the ultimate performance of consciousness. They want the cultural capital of being in the work without having to endure the quiet, unglamorous reality of actually doing the work.
So Marcus finally has enough. He looks at the actor and says, "Listening ain't a personality. It's a behavior. And behaviors don't clap."
Ouch.
The men get incredibly defensive and start arguing that they need this public therapy space to figure out how to dismantle oppressive systems. Marcus shuts the entire production down with one line. Therapy fix rooms, systems-owned buildings.
And to touch briefly on the political neutrality of this text, the creator is not taking a left-wing or right-wing stance here.
Right, we should clarify that.
The comic is not mocking the concept of feminism, nor is it mocking the genuine need for psychological healing. It is impartially, ruthlessly mocking the commodification of those concepts. It is pointing out how quickly a radical movement for liberation can be turned into a branding exercise for influencers.
I love how you phrase that. For me, Marcus walking onto a podcast or a panel is like a municipal health inspector walking into a greasy fast food kitchen.
Okay, I like this.
Like, the inspector isn't there to eat the burger. He doesn't care about the vibe or the music playing in the dining room. He's just walking around with a clinical flashlight, pointing out the rat droppings behind the fryer and reading off the health code violations from a clipboard.
He's just doing the math.
Exactly. And what happens? Everyone in the restaurant gets furious at him for ruining the vibe. They just wanted to eat their terrible, greasy burger in peace.
That analogy is perfect because it predicts the exact reaction of the ecosystem. When the health inspector ruins the illusion of the kitchen, the restaurant doesn't clean up. They just attack the inspector.
Shoot the messenger.
Right. Which leads directly to the viral outrage cycle. The system has to generate a massive backlash to discredit Marcus.
Yes, the Marcus must be stopped arc on Twitter.
Mm.
It is a masterpiece of internet sociology. Someone takes a tiny, out-of-context clip of Marcus saying, "Substance without consistency is a lecture," and the timeline completely loses its mind.
The internet does what the internet does.
The quote tweets are flying. People are accusing him of hating black men who think. Political accounts are calling him a dangerous centrist, while others are calling him a literal CIA plant sent to disrupt the culture.
Everyone projects their own enemy onto him.
Right. A digital magazine publishes a 5,000-word think piece titled, "Why Marcus is Dangerous to the Discourse." People start misquoting him in all caps, screaming, "He said ownership doesn't matter."
Which is the exact opposite of what he said.
We see Marcus sitting at his kitchen table, just scrolling through this inferno on his phone. He mutters, "I said it don't trend." He takes a sip of his coffee and realizes the brutal mathematical truth of the modern internet. He says, "I went viral for context." That's a new one.
The mechanism of that backlash is incredibly important. The internet ecosystem misquotes him intentionally to create engagement because, as the text implies, context is the enemy of virality. Nuance does not generate clicks.
It really doesn't.
The social media machine requires a constant rotation of clearly defined heroes and villains to keep the users emotionally stimulated. Because Marcus refuses to be either, because he is just a flat mirror, the internet has to forcefully project a villainous persona onto him just to keep the content machine burning.
Wow. If human systems like the macroeconomy, the HOA, the federal government, the podcast networks, the social media algorithms, if they are this aggressively performative, this fundamentally broken, and this allergic to actual truth, it makes perfect sense why the people living inside the comics universe eventually decide to just opt out entirely.
Why play a rigged game?
Exactly. Why participate in a game that actively punishes you for knowing the rules? This leads us into the most surreal, sweeping, and brilliant arc in the entire run. The Mayor Goodboy storyline.
This is where the script pushes far beyond the grounded domestic satire of The Simpsons and fully embraces the surreal, biting, almost apocalyptic satire of The Boondocks. It takes a completely absurd premise and follows it to its terrifyingly logical conclusion.
I couldn't believe this arc when I read it. So the small town of Rabbit Haas, Kentucky, is holding a mayoral election. And the voters are so completely exhausted by decades of human corruption, embezzlement, and incompetence that they decide to elect a literal dog.
A literal dog!
Baxter, a purebred Labrador retriever, wins the mayoral race in a historic landslide. The panels show Baxter sitting in a massive leather chair behind the mayor's desk, happily panting, wearing a tiny custom-made mayoral sash.
It's such a great visual.
And because the town charter requires a human to sign the paperwork, the city council hires Marcus on a contract basis to interpret Baxter's barks into viable civic policy.
Because, you know, the council doesn't want Marcus to actually govern. They just need a human being to launder the absurdity of the situation into acceptable bureaucratic language.
It leads to these incredible scenes. They're in a high-stakes budget meeting. The city treasurer is sweating, pointing at a chart, saying the town is facing a massive fiscal deficit and they need leadership.
And what does Baxter do?
Mayor Baxter hears the tense tone, drops his favorite tennis ball, and rolls onto his back, exposing his belly.
Good boy.
The council looks at Marcus in a panic. Marcus doesn't even blink. He calmly translates. The mayor proposes belly rub incentives to stimulate small business growth in the downtown corridor. And the entire city council erupts into applause.
They love it.
Later, a cynical political reporter shows a microphone in Marcus's face and demands to know how a dog with zero experience can run a city. Baxter just tilts his head in confusion. Marcus looks at the camera and says, he's not a career politician, he's an outsider.
That's all the public needs to hear.
The crowd goes absolutely wild. Baxter's approval rating hits 78%. Marcus writes in his notebook, people like simple.
We really have to unpack the massive intellectual thesis hidden beneath the joke of a dog in a tie. This entire arc is a masterclass in dissecting proxy leadership and what Uncle Reggie later coins as the leash economy.
The leash economy.
Yes. The creator is making a very dark observation about modern democracy. It proves that voters have been so traumatized by the political class that they no longer actually want a leader. They just want a mascot.
They just want to feel good.
Right. They want the emotional comfort of political branding without the messy, disappointing reality of human flaws. I mean, a dog can't accept a bribe from a developer. A dog can't have a scandal.
And of course, wherever there is an illusion, Uncle Reggie is there trying to monetize it. Reggie sees Baxter's poll numbers and immediately launches a new agency called Pet Candidate Consulting.
Of course he does.
His official corporate tagline is authenticity without accountability. He starts traveling to neighboring towns, pitching different breeds of dogs to run for local office. He stands in front of a projector showing a pie chart. The dog trust index is polling at 84%, while the human trust index is at a dismal 19%.
Sad, but probably accurate.
Reggie tells Marcus, people forgive fur. They don't forgive taxes. He starts brokering a stoic German shepherd to run for governor and a mixed breed coalition to take over the state Congress.
He's building an empire.
Marcus watches this empire building and asks Reggie a very practical question. He says, but what about the actual policy? Who writes the laws? Reggie just smiles and replies, handlers.
Handlers run the city anyway. Reggie accidentally stumbles upon the deepest truth of the political system.
Yeah, that it's all a front.
Right. The figurehead on the poster rarely writes the legislation. The unseen bureaucratic apparatus does. And the creator takes this terrifying truth and escalates it to its absolute breaking point.
You mean the human dog candidate?
Yes. The moment the satire turns back on humanity.
So the neighboring town has an election. And a human man decides to run for mayor, but he realizes he can't win against a dog. So he puts on a leather-studded collar, refuses to speak English, and officially identifies as a canine.
It's so absurd.
A reporter corners him and asks, but you're biologically human. Why are you wearing a collar? The man calmly adjusts the leather strap around his neck and repeats Reggie's line. Handlers run the city anyway.
He knows how the game is played.
They hold a televised debate. The human dog candidate debates a golden retriever. The human dog promises expanded kennel access across the city. Marcus is watching the debate on TV and points out that kennel access is just a rebranding of zoning laws.
Same policies, new packaging.
And the terrifying part. The human dog wins the election. Marcus is walking out of City Hall with his little nephew, Malik. Malik looks at the human mayor wearing a collar and asks what actually changed. Marcus looks at the leash trailing behind the mayor and says, "The leash." Still attached.
And the creator doesn't stop at the local level. The satire scales up globally to show the inevitable conclusion of this trend.
Right, the UN summit.
We get a montage of the UN Global Breed Order Summit. Norway has elected a wolf as prime minister. France is represented by a poodle chancellor. The delegates are using translation headsets to argue over the implementation of leash transparency acts.
It's pure chaos.
And the human labor market completely collapses because citizens realize that dogs aren't required to pay rent or file income taxes. So millions of people are trying to legally transition into golden retrievers just to escape the crushing burden of the economy.
Wow.
It is a terrifyingly logical conclusion. If a society structures its economy to make being a human being financially unbearable, humans will naturally optimize their way out of the species.
So bringing this out of the comic and into reality, What does this mean for us? I think about the dog mayor, and I think about how a city functions. If a Labrador can sit in the mayor's chair, and the trash still gets picked up, and the taxes still get collected, and the zoning laws still get passed, does the mayor actually matter?
Well, that's the question.
It's like looking at the driver of a massive freight train. The driver gets to sit in the big chair, wear the cool striped hat, and blow the loud whistle when they pull into the station. But they aren't actually steering the train.
Yeah, they're not.
The tracks were laid down 100 years ago. The train is going exactly where the steel tracks dictate, regardless of whether a human, a dog, or a mannequin is sitting in the conductor's seat.
That analogy captures the exact philosophical point Marcus arrives at during the epilogue of the mayoral arc. Marcus and his wife, Tasha, decide to take a night off and go to a local comedy club.
Oh, the comedian's monologue.
Yeah, the comedian on stage is pacing back and forth, delivering this incredibly profound monologue disguised as a stand-up routine. He says that the political villain keeps getting updated like software.
Right.
He notes that first, the villain was the wealthy white man. Then they changed the branding, and the villain was the wealthy white woman. Now, the town has elected a dog. But the comedian stops, leans into the mic, and says, I'm not saying the dog is evil. I'm saying the leash ain't new.
The leash ain't new.
Every time we figure out how the system works, the system just changes costumes. And we spend all our energy arguing about the new costume. Meanwhile, it's the exact same landlord collecting the rent.
That scene gave me chills when I read it.
It's powerful.
So Marcus and Tasha leave the club and are walking home down the quiet suburban street. They walk past all these discarded campaign posters with dogs and humans on them. Marcus looks at the debris, looks up at the streetlights, and delivers the final thesis of the storyline. He says, they keep changing the mascot. System don't.
Changing the mascot?
It completely shatters the illusion of the X-ray machine we talked about at the beginning. It demands that you look at your own real-world political and corporate systems and ask the most uncomfortable question possible. Who is actually holding the leash?
Who owns the steel tracks the train is running on? Because it certainly isn't the person wearing the conductor's hat.
Exactly. But staring at the massive, global, immovable tracks of the system can be incredibly demoralizing.
It's exhausting.
So we have to take a breath from the macro-level absurdity and zoom all the way back into the micro. How does a guy like Marcus, someone who sees the matrix of the funhouse so clearly, who knows the train is on a fixed track, how does he protect his own family from being crushed by those systems?
Right. What's his actionable strategy?
Because he doesn't run for office. He doesn't start a podcast. He does it by quietly, methodically teaching the next generation how to read the blueprints. And this brings us to the emotional and intellectual core of the entire text, Passing the Torch and Malik's Education in Reality.
The dynamic between Marcus and his young nephew, Malik, is the anchor of the comic. Without Malik, Marcus is just a cynic.
Yeah, he's just a guy complaining.
But with Malik, Marcus becomes a quiet revolutionary. Marcus refuses to treat this 6-year-old boy like a child. He doesn't coddle him with fairy tales about how fair the world is. He treats Malik like an employee, a student, and an equal. He teaches him structural reality from day one.
My absolute favorite storyline in the entire run is the registered agent arc. It is so brilliant.
It's hilarious.
So, Uncle Reggie is trying to launch yet another incredibly sketchy, buzzword-heavy business. He watched a YouTube video that said real businesses incorporate in Delaware for tax loopholes. So he decides to file an LLC in Delaware. But he needs a registered agent with an official address on the paperwork.
Naturally.
Since little Malik technically went to kindergarten in Delaware for a few months, Reggie uses the 6-year-old's name on the federal forms.
Identity fraud, basically.
Pretty much. And to keep the kid quiet, Reggie verbally promises Malik a 10% ownership stake in the company. Fast forward a few months, and by sheer blind luck, Reggie's hustle accidentally generates a real profit of $230. One afternoon, a piece of official mail arrives from Malik. It's a Schedule K-1 tax form from the IRS stating that Malik has officially earned $23 in corporate profit.
And we see Malik sitting on the living room rug, holding this tax document, completely confused because his piggy bank is empty. He never received a single dollar bill.
Right. He brings the paper to Marcus. Marcus sits down on the floor with him and calmly explains the difference between accounting and reality. He tells Malik that the $23 is legal profit, but, quote, cash is optional.
A hard lesson for a kid.
Marcus taps the tax form and says, congratulations. You an entrepreneur now. What follows is just the funniest sequence in the comic. Later that week, Reggie is pacing in the living room, aggressively pitching another scalable business idea to the family. Little 6-year-old Malik raises his hand, interrupts Reggie, and says, as a minority shareholder, I have concerns regarding your overhead.
Oh, good.
Marcus is sitting on the couch, sipping his coffee, and he just smirks and whispers, corporate governance.
It's hilarious, but the underlying lesson is profound.
It gets better. The next day, Malik corners Reggie in the kitchen and formally demands his $23 cash dividend.
He wants his money.
Reggie gets defensive. He starts using his venture capital vocabulary, telling the kid that the capital is currently tied up in logistics and is being aggressively reinvested for Q3 growth.
Selling the feeling again.
Right. So Marcus leans down, looks Malik in the eye, and delivers his first real business lesson. He says, money moves faster than explanations. If they talking, they stalling.
That is just such a great line. Marcus's true rebellion against the system isn't going on podcasts, and it isn't getting fired from the HOA board. His rebellion is educating Melick.
Yeah.
Because while the entire structure of society, the schools, the media, the corporate HR departments, is actively trying to train Malik to be an obedient, compliant worker who asks for permission, Marcus is rigorously training him to be an owner. He is teaching this child how to see the matrix of legal and financial structures that dictate human behavior.
While everyone else in the comic is frantically trying to protect Malik's feelings by lying to him about how the world works, Marcus is protecting Malik's future by telling him the brutal truth.
Exactly.
He's teaching a six-year-old how to read the fine print of the social contract. We see this play out beautifully on the school field trip to Washington, D.C.
Oh, yes. The quintessential performance of American mythology. The teacher is walking the kids through the Capitol building, giving the standard, highly idealized tour. She points to the rotunda and says, "This is the room where the people's voice is represented."
And what does Marcus say?
Marcus, who is chaperoning, is standing in the back. He just mutters, "They schedule it."
The kids are looking at the monuments, and Malik tugs on Marcus's sleeve. He asks a very childish, binary question. He says, "Uncle Marcus, is the president a good guy or a bad guy?"
The way a child views the world. Good or bad.
Right. And Marcus kneels down and breaks the entire concept of American power into an analogy that a child can understand, but most adults refuse to accept.
It is a breathtaking piece of writing.
Morris looks at the Capitol Dome and tells Malik that America is just a giant company. He says it's like Amazon, but with an army.
Amazon with an army.
He explains that a president is essentially just a CEO. The CEO gets to make decisions, but the invisible board of directors actually hires the CEO. Which means the CEO doesn't truly own the company. Marcus says presidents matter, but systems matter more.
And then he explains the mood of the country.
Yes. He then explains that countries, like people, have moods. He says when the country feels scared, the board picks a strong, loud CEO. When the country feels tired and wants to sleep, they pick a soft, quiet CEO. It's the exact same company. They just change their posture.
The teacher overhears this and gets furious.
She does. She angrily accuses Marcus of being cynical and poisoning the minds of the children. Marcus doesn't raise his voice at all. He just corrects her. It's not cynical. It's structural.
He is deliberately stripping away the romantic mythology of the state and showing the child the gears turning inside the machine. And he applies that exact same structural lens to spirituality in the faith as fashion strip.
Oh, that one is beautiful.
It really is. Malik comes home from school confused about religion. He asks Marcus what religion their family is, and Marcus doesn't give him dogma. He explains that everybody wakes up on this planet, looks around, and realizes that something feels deeply off.
Like a baseline level of anxiety.
Right. And most people just ignore that feeling and go to work. Some people try to build things to fix it. But every now and then, across history, somebody comes along who can perfectly put words to that strange feeling. Marcus tells Malik, that person is a prophet.
I love how he defines that. Marcus says they don't invent the feeling. They just put the right words on it so we can see it.
Exactly. But then Marcus explains the tragic, inevitable cycle of how inspiration becomes an institution. He tells Malik that people naturally flock to the prophet because they feel understood. But the prophet is just a human, and they usually don't get to stay around very long.
And what happens when they're gone?
Once the prophet is gone, the followers are left with a choice. They can either try to live the difficult message every day, or what usually happens is that institutions take the prophet's words and start wearing them like clothes.
Wearing them like clothes.
Yes. Marcus looks at Malik and says, that's why there are a dozen different religions that all kind of feel the same deep down. It's the exact same message. They're just wearing different outfits. It is a profoundly respectful yet entirely structural breakdown of how raw human faith is inevitably processed into organized religion.
It's beautiful. And consider the profound long-term impact of that kind of education. Think about what happens when Malik grows up.
He's going to be unshakable.
If a child is raised to constantly see the strings attached to the puppets, they can never be turned into a mascot by a political party. They can never be manipulated by Uncle Reggie's exhausting pre-liquid hustle because they understand the difference between venture capital and the cardboard box of essential oils.
They won't buy the $40 pen.
Exactly. Malik will never buy the $40 pen from the president or the salesman because he understands that the pen doesn't grant you power. It just writes.
By prioritizing the teaching of ownership over compliance, Marcus is actively ensuring that Malik will not be consumed by the bureaucratic systems that constantly chew up and spit out characters like Uncle Reggie, the HOA president, and the podcast hosts.
Right. He's inoculated against it.
He is. Malik will understand the difference between a broken window and the hand holding the rock. He will know exactly when to ask the institution for permission and when to completely ignore it. He will understand that the societal X-ray machine we use to diagnose our world is fundamentally broken. But because of Marcus, he will know how to read the shadows on the film anyway.
And that brings us to the end of our journey today. Let's pull all of these threads together. Marcus is clearly not just a comic strip about a deadpan guy who smirks at his chaotic family. It is a brilliant, uncompromising, multi-layered thesis on how to survive the modern world with your sanity intact.
It really is a survival guide.
Whether Marcus is dodging the HR department's demand for optional excellence during Corporate Black History Month, or literally translating tax policy for a Labrador mayor, or watching his six-year-old nephew demand a cash dividend from his grifter uncle, the creator forces us to look unblinkingly at the invisible systems that govern our everyday lives. The comic demands that we stop arguing on the internet about the costume the landlord is wearing today and realize that we are still the ones paying the rent.
I want to connect this directly back to the reality you are living in right now. You are interacting with these exact same systems every single day.
We all are.
You navigate the marketing funnels, the exhausting hustle culture, the corporate demands for alignment, the bizarre political theater. The source material asks you to critically examine your participation in all of it.
Yeah, to really look at what you're doing.
So the next time you are faced with a choice, whether it's a purchase, a vote, or an argument online, ask yourself, are you buying the pen because you actually need to write something down on a piece of paper? Or are you buying it because you are desperately trying to be sold the feeling of power and control in a world that actively denies you both?
Think about the lesson Marcus taught Malik regarding the registered agent. Think about that shattered X-ray machine we talked about at the top of the show. You are living your life inside the Funhouse mirror room.
We all are.
So take a hard look at the systems in your own life.
Yeah.
Your corporate job, your social media presence, your neighborhood association, your community at large. Are you actually an owner collecting a tangible dividend from your participation? Or are you just absorbing the liability for a system that is actively wearing you like an outfit? Until next time, keep diving.